Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Nick Cage Smooches Good edition. It's Wednesday, April 27th, 2022. On today's show, The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent is a meta comedy action thriller starring Nick Cage as himself or a version of himself. It also stars Pedro Pascal and Sharon Horgan. And then Breaking Bad, of course, has a prequel spinoff, Better Call Saul. It's coming back for its sixth season. We'll be joined by Isaac Butler to discuss. And finally, its founder has said Twitter is the closest thing to a global consciousness. Well, global consciousness is about to become the lock, stock, and barrel possession of Elon Musk. We'll be joined by Washington Post tech columnist Will Oremus to discuss the implications of this fact. Joining me today are Julia Turner, the deputy managing editor of the LA Times. Hey, Julia.
Hello, hello.
And of course, Dana Stevens is the film critic for Slate and the author of the hit book, Cameraman, a beautiful book-length essay about the career of Buster Keaton. Things still has legs, right?
I guess so. I just went to LA, saw Julia there, actually, and did some book promotion. So I guess people still want to hear about it. So I'm going to keep on talking about it.
Marvelous. We ready to make a show?
Please.
All right. Very good. The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent stars Nick Cage as a kind of live-action cartoon version of himself. So right away, we're like meta on meta on meta here because Nick Cage is already a kind of live-action cartoon of himself. The joke here is that this shtick, it just isn't working anymore. His star is fading. The offers are drying up. He's turned into something of an embarrassment to his wife and kid. So he decides to take a famous person's dead ender of a gig. He'll get $1 million for flying to Mallorca and hanging out with a rich fan on his birthday. There, however, in Spain, he gets a double surprise. The rich fan is an incredibly sweet, like really endearing Spanish, you know, sort of middle-aged rich kid who adores Cage. And the two legitimately hit it off. They become fast buddies. The second surprise comes when the CIA recruits Cage on the fly to spy on his new buddy, who they claim is a ruthless crime boss. The film stars Pedro Pascal as his host and Sharon Horgan as his wife. Why don't we listen to a clip? In this scene, Javi Gutierrez, played by Pascal, is trying to convince Nick Cage not to quit acting.
I'm sorry, but you can't quit acting. You can't.
That's none of your business.
Whether you like it or not, you have a gift. And that gift brings light and joy to an increasingly dark and broken world. And to turn your back on that gift is to turn your back on the entire human race.
The human race? I'm afraid so.
I'm so glad to hear this little preview of your reaction to this movie. I laughed all the way through it. That's fabulous, Julia. Oh my God, you're losing your... gather yourself, woman. All right.
I'll try.
Well, Dana, since you're the one remaining model of composure on this panel, I'll start with you. This movie is a romp. It's kind of silly in its own way. What'd you make of it?
I mean, I was both amused by portions of this movie, even delighted by some parts, mainly scenes like that scene and some later ones where, you know, we just get really goofy buddy comedy between, you know, this fake outsized version of the already outsized Nicolas Cage and Pedro Pascal. I mean, that bro bonding kind of stuff is golden in this movie. Incredibly well written, well acted, and charming. However, this movie also disappoints in some ways to me. I mean, it also has this crime plot that you mentioned that I think seemed incredibly underscripted and disappointing. There's this whole side story where Tiffany Haddish is a CIA agent who's surveilling them, and she and Ike Barinholtz, another CIA agent, are trying to solve the mystery of, you know, this Spanish crime boss while following them around. And there's all kinds of action scenes based on that that, to me, started to feel really generic by the end. I don't know. I mean, in general, I would send people to this movie if they liked that scene and laughed at it as Julia did. And if they're interested in Nick Cage and the myth of Nick Cage, which I think is actually a fascinating thing to explore, but which, again, this movie could have done with another script pass to explore that meta side of itself better. Another ongoing theme in this movie is that Nick Cage's younger self, played by a digitally de-aged Nick Cage, styled like his early 90s, you know, over-the-top persona, comes and scolds him for having let his career slide so much. But there's something about that metaverse that doesn't quite make sense, because in fact, it's not the case that Nick Cage's career is in decline, nor is it the case that he only takes crass action blockbuster roles. In fact, just last year we talked about him in Pig, right? This very unusual indie that he appeared in that was, you know, incredibly introspective and was just a very strange vehicle for somebody who's a big star. In fact, if anything, Nick Cage's career has been characterized by wildly swerving between arty kinds of roles and, you know, big He-Man action roles. And you never know what Nick Cage is going to do next, which is part of the charm. So I guess I wish that there had been a more interesting meta story attached to him than just, he's a broken down drunk who needs to pull himself together. I think maybe a smarter investigation of his career would have gotten even more meta and kind of looked at what he's been doing all along that's been so self-reflexive. I mean, this is the guy who's already played two of himself in adaptation, right? And he's changed faces with John Travolta in Face Off, and he's always been somebody who plays with identity. You can actually probably tell that I'm writing a piece on this right now. I'm writing about Nick Cage, not just in this movie, but, you know, as a very metaverse inhabiting actor from the beginning. And I don't think this movie is as smart and as funny a movie as he deserves, but in stretches, it is funny enough.
Dana!
Yeah, Julia, it sounds like you and I may agree about this movie, but it sounds like Dana needed a tincture of Charlie Kaufman or something. What about you? Did you
She needed to drop acid before seeing this movie, as happens in the film.
Which apparently you did, so.
I loved this movie. I just thought this movie was like pure joy in cinema form. And I realize that this is becoming a creaky trope of our show that every week, based on whether or not I like the movie that we saw, I pronounce film dead or alive. But now, having seen Everything Everywhere All at Once and then this movie in a row, I'm like, two super fun creative movies that do totally funny things and entertain me for an hour. And we're not about Marvel villains or comics or the Batman or, also, and neither of them seem like kind of turgid Oscar bids. Like, what a delight. What a joy. What a beautiful house in Mallorca. What a hilariously over-emotive performance by Pedro Pascal. What wryly self-acknowledging. I mean, like, yes, I guess there is a version of this movie that is, like, actually grappling in the most serious possible way with the contours of the true Nick Cage's career, but, like, no, it's not that much of a stretch to imagine Nick Cage as, you know, the washed-up star of Con Air and just, like, a lied pig out of the picture. And, like, you know, he does famously have, like, debt troubles and spending troubles, and he sort of, maybe it would have made more sense for this to come out before Pig instead of after, but he kind of has had a little bit less prominence and centrality and visibility. It's not too far of a stretch. But I don't think the movie needs to be, like, a deeply accurate summation of his wrestling with his whole career to be just an utter fucking delight from beginning to end. Like,
yeah, it's a UFD. I agree. It's an utter fucking delight. Julia, you have given me the courage to believe in myself again, because I laughed my ass off all alone in a fucking movie theater for 90 plus 100 minutes or whatever it was. And I was like, am I, like, fucked up on, like, did I take cold medicine and I've forgotten or something? Like, what? Why am I? I dug it so much. I thought the early portion of the movie was sharp. I thought it was really sharply drawn, and in fact was getting at something, you know, it was getting at something subtle through the broadest channel possible, which is that persona and person just blend together for people who've become stars in a way that's, you know, because you're sort of playing yourself. If you're a movie star by definition, right, like academics agree, the definition is you are partially or substantially playing yourself in movie after movie after movie. And people go back to see you as X, not an actor as X, right? You do not fully disappear into the role if you're Jack Nicholson. That's not what your audience wants. And Cage is that on steroids, to use a tired metaphor, but he is. And it has bled into and infected his life. The second thing I thought it was in a way poignant about was that, you know, in The Method by Isaac Butler, who's coming on the show later, he writes about the emergence in the 1980s of an anti-method style with, I would suppose, Tom Cruise and Nick Cage as two of his principal examples. Like Cruise, who thinks, has always explicitly thought about acting as from the outside in. He literally studied himself in the mirror to learn how to gesture and act. He was not looking for an authentic inner core and then ways to physicalize and express it. And then Cage, for whom it's just an, you know, Nietzschean mask beneath, you know, Nietzschean mask beneath mask beneath mask. It's like, where is my face? You know, it's sort of not there at all in a way. And it's poignant about how that era really has come to an end. The blockbuster era, the wide release era, the kind of gigantic, overmarketed, like Simpson-Bruckheimer production that's carried by a star and a huge budget and a huge marketing campaign. It's like, it's not the business model anymore. And it's not the basic ethos of the culture either. And it's left Cage kind of neither here nor there. And I think he surprised people, surprised me with Pig, that he could go that quiet. I mean, this one, it reminded me of a movie I love whose charm is that it's, if it were any better, it wouldn't be as endearing, which is the old Charles Grodin, Robert De Niro, buddy pick.
Midnight Run.
Yeah. I mean, just like some of those moments are between Grodin and De Niro are amazing, right? And this approximates them, that they're just so lovably silly with each other and what they're bringing out in one another. And shout out to Pascal. That is a tough, tough role. And he's marvelous in this movie.
No, it's true. I mean, everything that you're saying applies completely to the scenes between the two of them. There's a fantastic scene where they explore the shrine, the Nick Cage shrine that this Playboy billionaire has in his house. And Nick Cage offers to buy this terrible wax figure of himself. And I feel like that's everything that this movie should have been. That truly was exploring like the absurd mystery of Nick Cage's off-screen persona, you know, the great bro comedy. And I did feel some Midnight Run goodness. I don't think this is anywhere near the movie that Midnight Run is, but some of that kind of bro comedy on the run happens toward the end. For example, that gag near the end when they're being chased and they switch shoes just because they like each other's shoes and then proceed to complain about the new shoes that they have on. Which, why would you do that in the middle of being chased by people with guns? It's just, there's something so great and absurd about that.
Oh, it's so good.
But I still say the Tiffany Haddish scenes felt like they were written in 10 seconds so that there could be some kind of action plot.
They were.
Sharon Horgan is completely wasted as Nick Cage's wife. She's a very funny comedian, and all she gets to do is sort of be the frustrated wife.
Not,
I mean, the script
end,
needed another pass.
The end of the movie, towards the end of the movie, but yes.
I guess she gets a tiny moment, but I feel like this moment needed one more pass through the old editing machine and polishing. But that said, the director and co-writer Tom Gormican, his previous movie to this, which was called The Awkward Moment, was an absolute flop and was a really, really terrible attempt at a buddy comedy, a sort of comedy about three male roommates. And I remember seeing it and thinking, I hope that I never have to see anything by that filmmaker again.
Whoopsie.
And so I have to hand it to Tom Gormican, because if this had been his debut, I would have said, I cannot wait to see what he does next. And that is how I feel about him now.
I hear you on the underwrittenness, but also this movie is an hour 45. It goes by in a breeze. Like, I don't know that I needed to like seriously understand Tiffany Haddish's motivation. And I actually think the strength of the performances across the board makes it all work. Like, mm-hmm. I think Sharon Horgan actually turns an underwritten part into like a fully realized human. And it just reminded me how much I love Sharon Horgan and everything. And yeah, Tiffany Haddish and her sidekick Ike Barinholtz are slightly cardboard cutouty, but not in any way that made me sad.
You're right. Yeah. Maybe I'm just being churlish. I mean, this movie is a fun romp. It doesn't go as deep as it could. It's not Adaptation 2. And maybe because of its closeness in theme and subject matter to Adaptation, I was expecting a little bit more from it on that front. But I completely agree. We all need more short-running movie romps with goofy, fun performances. And this is totally that. So yes, go be like Julia and not like me.
Yes, ignore the infamous churl, Dana Stevens, and go see this movie. It's fun. All right, it's The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, starring Nick Cage. It's in theaters now. It's not streaming, but check it out. It's really fun.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right. Now is the moment in our show when we discuss business. Typically, Dana, I'm sure we have some. What's up today?
Stephen, our only item of business is to tell you about today's Slate Plus segment. I love this week's Slate Plus segment, Steve, because it is a little bit of a goof on you, but I think you too will enjoy it. This week, we are going to talk about the connection between real and imagined places, a topic that was prompted by last week's episode when we were talking about the show Slow Horses, the British spy drama, and it's about a bunch of deadbeat British spies who work in a place derogatively nicknamed Slough House. Steve then mentioned that Slough is a fictional British town dreamed up by the poet John Betjeman. But then a lot of listeners, and I've been keeping up with these emails because I'm getting a kick out of them, probably about, I don't know, a dozen or so listeners have written in to say that Slough is in fact a very real place in Britain, although it has been much mocked in British culture, including in the show The Office and on this new show Slow Horses. There is a real life Slough. My personal belief is that we now owe Slough a live show and that some institution in that town should reach out to us and invite us to come and visit and experience the wonders of Slough. But in the meantime, we are going to do a Slate Plus segment, and this was Stephen's idea, that we explore the relationship between real and imagined places, places that are out there in the world, and how we imagine them or imagine non-existent places in our minds. That may sound conceptual, but Steve pitched it to us as a Slate Plus idea, and I actually think it's going to be a really fun segment.
Okay, let me hear leap in and just say, first of all, that all dozen or so emails were so gentle and so sweet about it. You know, nobody seized up and you know, pinned me to the wall with this, but I did feel it was just clownish on so many levels, because I've literally been on an English train and a London area train passing through Slough and thought to myself, wow, I guess it's a real place. And you know, Dana, I massively, heartily endorse the idea of a Slough live show. I'd love to do that. That would be so fun.
Yes, please. People of Slough, reach out to us. I don't think anybody who actually wrote in was from Slough. I think most of them from other parts of England, but they definitely all responded in its defense, even though a couple of them also poked a bit of fun at Slough. If you're a Slate Plus member, you can hear us talk about Slough and other real and imaginary places in our Slate Plus segment at the end of the show. And if you're not a Slate Plus member, you can sign up today at slate.com/culture plus. What you get when you're a member: ad-free podcasts, bonus segments like the one I just described, which exist on many other shows as well, and unlimited access to all of the writing on slate.com. I should also mention that you would be supporting our work and the work of all our great colleagues when you're a member. These memberships matter a lot to Slate and to us. So please sign up today at slate.com/culture plus. Once more, that's slate.com/culture plus.
All right, well, Better Call Saul, of course, it's the spin-off prequel from Breaking Bad from creator Vince Gilligan. It stars Bob Odenkirk as Saul, kind of, not really, actually. We open on him as Jimmy McGill, and we follow his evolution into the character we grew to know and equivocally love on Breaking Bad. I should say, I have been meaning to watch this show forever. I'm dying to do it. I am not only not caught up, I haven't watched it since the very beginning of the first season. So replacing me for the following segment is none other than Isaac Butler. Isaac, hey, how are you?
Good, doing well. Just got back from LA Times Book Fest, and boy, are my arms tired.
So, of course, you're the author of The Method, the story of method acting in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, we have a clip from the show, of course. Dana, why don't you set it up?
Sure. In this clip, you're going to hear Bob Odenkirk as Jimmy McGill, who, as you'll hear in this segment, is starting to reinvent himself at this point as the lawyer Saul Goodman, talking to Rhea Seehorn as Kim. They're in a Mexican restaurant, and she's helping him to scheme about how to create this new persona.
So Saul Goodman drives a brown Ford Taurus.
Detroit calls that taupe, I believe.
Don't you think Saul Goodman would drive something with a little more flair?
Such as?
I don't know. Definitely American-made. Something showy. And Saul Goodman has an office. Something eye-catching. Good location.
By the courthouse?
Yeah. A cathedral of justice.
Oh, a cathedral of justice. Okay, yeah.
We should start looking for something for you. I mean, for Saul.
Sold. When do we start?
Saturday's good.
Saturday it is.
All right, I'm going to jump into this conversation with the caveat to Julia and Isaac that I've seen every minute of this show except for the very last episode, which I'm about to watch next time I have a free moment to watch it. So if you spoil anything, I will end our friendships immediately. But I will start off by saying, that this is probably my favorite show on TV right now. But it has been a long wait between season 5 and season 6, the last season of the show, which just started a couple weeks ago, because of the pandemic. And of course, because of Bob Odenkirk's heart attack, which I think slowed down filming considerably. Thank goodness he's better now. And, you know, I think he's totally on the mend. But I'm so, so happy to have it back. I want to hear a little bit about y'all's history with it and just sort of whether you agree with me that it's maybe the best thing going on TV right now. Granted, I am not the biggest TV consumer, so maybe I don't have the right to say that. But please support me or attack me.
I mean, you have the right to say whatever you want in the Slate Culture Gabfest, Dana. I'm definitely not going to tell you that you don't have the right to make a wild pronouncement, especially since I have my own history of making wild pronouncements about this show. I remember completely falling in love with it, being really blown away. And at the end of season 2, I wrote a piece for Slate called Better Call Saul is Better Than Breaking Bad. And, you know, made the argument that for all of the hype and heat and fervor surrounding Breaking Bad, which was a wonderful show, that Better Call Saul was even better, more interesting, more concerned with more important aspects of the human condition, more mundane and thus more important aspects of the human condition, and that essentially the team that had been operating at the absolute top of its game in bringing Breaking Bad to its kind of crescendoing peak and finale, like they really dropped that show without a couple sad seasons of flabby denouement, had put all of their force into this really fascinating character who we know is going to turn out to be a smarmy drug lawyer, but who we meet as this like sweet, earnest guy with a talent for mischief who is, you know, just trying to be good, basically. Like, it's about the struggle to be a good person and what it means to be a good person. And I just absolutely loved it. I think the question for me that I'm still puzzling through is, as it has evolved in the past few years, like, do I think it is one of the best shows in the history of television, which I said I thought it would turn out to be, perhaps? I think it's pretty darn great. But I want to hear what Isaac has to say before we wrestle with that big question.
Yeah, I absolutely love the show. I love it so, so much. I miss it. I missed it so much when it wasn't on, you know, in that long gap that my wife had never seen Breaking Bad, but loves Better Call Saul. And so I rewatched all of Breaking Bad because, you know, we just needed to get that fix of that particular color of yellow, POV shots from objects and, you know, weird cinematography. I think it benefits a lot from Breaking Bad having had so many years to figure itself out. That was one of the things that the rewatch really drove home for me, is that season 1 of Breaking Bad is just a very different show from even the second season. The what we think of as its visual style actually doesn't evolve until very late. It's not until the episode Fly, directed by The Last Jedi's Rian Johnson, that like all of its visual pieces come together. And Saul as a character evolves significantly over the course of that show. And I think Odenkirk does as an actor as well. So it benefits from all of that stuff. But I thought it took all of that show's materials and questions in a way more interesting direction. And also, I just think that, you know, Jimmy and Kim and, you know, Michael McKean's character, Chuck, I just think they're more interesting, rich characters, frankly. And I think Rhea Seehorn's a real find. I had never seen her in anything before. We both took acting classes at the same place in DC. So, you know, I feel a kinship there. I love it. I will say that I'm the kind of person who really like wrestles with the things I love. So there's problems I have with it. I get every time it's sort of really setting up something in Breaking Bad, I lose interest a little bit. But whenever it's just about them and the characters and their evolution, I just love it.
Yeah, I was going to say something about what Julia mentioned about the mundanity of the show. I know that I've pounded the table about Better Call Saul to some people, and they've said, oh, well, Breaking Bad wasn't really for me. It was too violent. You know, I can't handle the gore. I think that one of the big strengths of Better Call Saul, not that it doesn't have plenty of, you know, violence and suspense in it. It's a show about crime, after all, and about, you know, somebody slowly falling into the underworld of crime. But it is a much gentler isn't the right word, but it is a show that is much more about relationships and about psychology. Not that those things were not strong in Breaking Bad as well, but there's not as much need for there to be a big kind of action sequence in every episode or for everything to be tending toward a life or death crisis. When those happen in Saul, it's more like it's a season ending moment, right? And then the repercussions of that moment of violence kind of unfold over the next season. I'm thinking in particular of last season and the trek through the desert. And this doesn't spoil anything if you haven't seen it, but yeah, there's a very harsh episode that has to do with Bob Odenkirk's character Saul being, or Jimmy being stranded in the desert and getting out of it. And the trauma of that really is unfolding now, even still in the beginning of season six. And it even took a while, and I like this in the show, for the physical traces of that trek through the desert to kind of fade away from his body, you know, his sunburn and his kind of haggard look from that day. So I think that this show is a little bit, again, gentle is not the right word, but it's a little more sensitive about dealing with trauma and the after effects of trauma than something like Breaking Bad, which, you know, I can understand that some viewers themselves felt traumatized by.
Here's my question for you guys. When I was proclaiming the joys of this show, I spoke a lot about the kind of confidence of its pacing, how it wasn't afraid to like show us, you know, all 27 steps of Mike Armantrout like drilling holes in a garden hose for a purpose unknown, and, you know, really relishing his like methodical care with the drill bits and the dappled Albuquerque sun on his shoulders, and, you know, the play, the sense of play with showing us something unexpected or putting the camera somewhere weird, or you better believe if they're spreading peanut butter on toast, your camera's going to be right in that peanut butter jar and watching that knife swirl it around. You know, like, has any of that worn thin for you? I feel like, does it ever seem a little too in love with its own quirky camera tricks? Like, some of those have worn less well for me over the seasons.
The one time that I actually felt that way, and I feel like this is not a spoiler, but the cold open of this week's episode, which is a cryptic image that does not make sense until the last 30 seconds of the episode, that unfolds over what feels like 30 minutes. It's like 2 minutes. You know, sometimes I'm like, all right, I know what show I'm watching. You don't have to remind me what show I'm watching.
No, it's really 2 minutes. I mean, Dana, this is not a spoiler. It's like 2 minutes of a camera roving through dirt and weeds. Like, you can't even really tell. like, are those roots? More brown expanse.
But in general, I just love, I don't know. I really enjoy its visual style. You know, it's been many, many years because it was also Breaking Bad's late visual style. And I am just, I don't know, I'm a sucker for it, I think.
I mean, thinking about it as an expanded universe of Breaking Bad, I'm not sure that I totally agree, Isaac, that everything that sets up Breaking Bad stories that would come later is a negative part of the show. And some of it, I feel like, is some of the most successful multiverse building I've ever seen. Like what happens to Gustavo Fring, right? Major character in Breaking Bad. We go back and see some of his story previously to that time. And, you know, I feel like I understand that character in a completely different way. Same thing with Mike Ehrmantraut, you know, everybody's favorite expressionless tough guy from Breaking Bad. We see a lot more of his family and backstory. And just in general, I mean, you could never have seen a minute of Breaking Bad and not know it existed. And I think this would still be a completely coherent universe of fascinating individuals. But if you have seen it, I actually think that some of that exploration of character backstory is as good as anything I've seen. And also because I feel like we haven't shouted out enough of the acting besides Bob Odenkirk's. I mean, Bob Odenkirk is the heart and soul of this show. It's impossible not to love and admire him as an actor as you watch it. But I mean, Rhea Seehorn and is extraordinary. I cannot wait till she gets her much deserved Emmy for the role of playing Kim. Jimmy and Kim's relationship is probably my favorite love relationship on TV right now. You believe that they love each other. You believe that they understand each other. You believe that they're terrible for each other. You know, you understand what they're like as roommates, as business partners, as, you know, friends, as enemies. It's just so complex and well-written and gorgeously acted. And also, I think we have to just shout out Michael Mando, who plays Nacho. I won't spoil too much about who this character is, but he's got a big story arc going for him right now at the beginning of this season. And I can tell they're going to be putting a lot more of the story on Nacho's shoulders. And I don't think there's been a secondary character on either of these two shows, Breaking Bad or Better Call Saul, that is, you know, as extraordinary to explore and as well acted as Nacho is turning into.
I mean, one of the nice things about a show that frequently has episodes without a ton of dialogue in them, you know, there's long, long, silent, wordless stretches. It almost feels like a Le Cirque Rouge or something with how little dialogue there can be in an episode, is that you really get to see the actors show off their abilities to listen and think in a way that feels active and interesting without indicating too much. And maybe this is because of all the, you know, methody stuff I've been focusing on over the past few years, but it's really refreshing and fun. Like, Nacho is a man of few words, but you really feel this kind of agonizing struggle he goes through over the course of the show. Kim is arguably in some ways, I think, a kind of underwritten character in those early seasons, but Rhea Seehorn really makes her into a fully fledged, complicated human being in a really profound way that's really stunning to watch.
Well, and yeah, her trajectory in terms of, you know, whatever we're going to call it, Breaking Bad, moving toward a world that's less ethical than the world she starts out in, is really complicated because she doesn't even directly benefit necessarily from the criminal activities that she's being drawn toward. There's almost a sense, and it's getting better written as the show goes on, but there's almost a sense that her character just wants to flirt with the dark side for the sake of doing so. You know, I mean, she's a public defender. She's obviously somebody who's very invested in the public good. She quits a corporate legal job because she doesn't want to be a money grubber. And yet she kind of can't tear herself away from this fascination with, you know, her boyfriend who is falling into the criminal underworld. So it's a great motivation for her character. And I fear for her every single week. The idea that something will happen to Kim keeps me up nights because I love that character so much.
Your point about Kim's arc is, to me, still what is so impressive about the show. Like, it is a show actually about more modest moral choices. Like, yes, they're flirting with the dark side. Yes, there are drug cartels. But somehow the scale and scope of the criminality and potential violence feels like it falls more towards the mundane, more towards the caper, more towards the believable. It's not quite as operatic as much of what we encountered in Breaking Bad, and that, you know, that mundanity allows the creators, and we haven't mentioned that Peter Gould and Vince Gilligan are both running this operation, but they use this world to explore just like basic moral choices. Like, Kim is so fascinating and so well acted, and, you know, I sort of think what she's drawn to is the feeling of exercising her own powers, right? Mm-hmm. Like, she's incredibly capable. She can apply her capability to help, like, Southwestern banks expand and, like, bulldoze neighbors in their effort to set up new branches, you know, but that doesn't feel right. She could just use her extreme powers of competence to, like, be a normal, straight-up public defender and help people with their problems and fight for justice. And she does derive pleasure from that, as she says this season. And yet, even for Kim, it's not enough. And I don't know that I'm sure she's being lured or misinfluenced by Jimmy. I mean, that's what I love about it, is sort of the complex play between the two of them, of the push-pull, of the fun, of the feeling of pulling something off and using the things that make them superhuman, their Elon Musk superpowers, which are not about boring companies, but just the ability to finesse situations. Like, they're drunk on those small powers, and that compulsion occludes their moral choices, and it's just mesmerizing to watch.
All right, well, we have three fists pounding the table for this one. Maybe you disagree with us and you have beefs with Better Call Saul. If so, you can write to us at culturefest@slate.com. But all I can say is, folks, give it a chance if you haven't, in my opinion, and apparently Julius and Isaac's too, best show on TV. Okay, on to the next segment.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
And it would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
All right, well, the news has recently broken that Elon Musk, the CEO, of course, of Tesla and the world's richest man, has an accepted offer to buy Twitter. We should say that this is pending a shareholder vote and Musk's own due diligence, whatever. He'll probably end up owning outright for a $44 billion price tag Twitter. We're joined by Will Oremus of The Washington Post to discuss this. Will, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
It's great to have you. We've missed you. It's been a long time.
Yeah, it's been years.
Yeah, let me quote you a tweet from Jack Dorsey, of course, the founder of Twitter. In principle, I don't believe anyone should own or run Twitter. It wants to be a public good at a protocol level, not a company. Solving for the problem of it being a company, however, Elon is the singular solution I trust. I trust his mission to extend the light of consciousness. Will, let's start you off with, it's not exactly a softball. Do you trust Elon Musk to extend the light of consciousness?
I do not trust Elon Musk to extend the light of consciousness. I think what Jack is trying to get at there is, like, all of Elon's projects are about saving the world, at least the ones before Twitter, right? Like, Tesla is about getting us transitioned to green energy, and then SpaceX is about giving us an escape plan so we can all go to Mars if things go to hell here on Earth. I don't know exactly how Twitter fits into the extending the light of consciousness idea. I think that Jack is probably rationalizing to some extent the fact that the richest guy in the world can do whatever he wants, and what he wants at this moment appears to be buying Twitter. I think that he does have one point buried in all the hokiness there, though, which is that Twitter has never been all that great of a company. It just doesn't make a lot of money. Advertisers don't love advertising on a site that's full of like toxicity and breaking news and vitriolic arguments. It's never been able to show the growth that Wall Street wants. Maybe if there's an upside here, it's that now that it has a private owner who has more money than God, it can focus on being a better product and not have to worry quite as much about being a better business.
It feels like the other big question slash fear that people, and I guess maybe by people, I mean journalists that I work with have, is, you know, Twitter has many communities that rely on it, although not as many as the people who hope to make money from Twitter would like. One of those communities is certainly journalists. Twitter's emphasis on the real time means that it is a great place for real time watching of sports and culture and real time discussing of things that happen, whether joyous or calamitous. And, you know, Elon Musk's relationship with journalists and journalism isn't the least fraught among our billionaires. So I think the question of what will happen to journalism and Twitter is a big one. And then, you know, another big question is, will Elon Musk revoke the ban on Trump's Twitter account? I mean, Twitter has been a very different place for the last couple of years without our all caps former POTUS on it. Do you have a sense of what indicators suggest Musk might do in these regards, or at least what people's fears are, or how people suss out what the options might be?
I think the fear on the left is that Musk will come in, ban all the journalists, reinstate Donald Trump, Alex Jones, and Milo Yiannopoulos, and turn Twitter basically into one of these like far-right platforms like Getter or Rumble. I can't even remember all the names. Truth Social, you know, the Trump platform. I think that's not likely. He did say yesterday something that could be a little reassuring, which is he said, to me, free speech means that even my worst critics should have a voice on this platform. So he is indicating that he wants to be tolerant of people's speech, whether he agrees with them or not. Now, I think that the real tension, and one of the things that people who work at Twitter and care about Twitter are worried about, is that Musk seems to have a somewhat simplistic vision of free speech. You know, Twitter until about 2016 or 2017 had a fairly laissez-faire attitude towards speech. It was kind of anything goes. It was like the answer to bad speech is more speech. And it was a pretty horrible place. I mean, it's not all daisies and unicorns today, but it can be easy to forget that 5 years ago, it was much worse. Like, people would harass and abuse and bully each other with impunity, and users could do almost nothing about it unless they happened to be famous and could like get Jack Dorsey on the phone. So I think that there is a fear that if he doesn't quickly evolve his views on what free speech means and start to understand that, like, just allowing anybody to say anything, including harassing other people, will actually chill the speech of a lot of people and make people feel unsafe to speak up. If he doesn't evolve those views, then Twitter could go back to sort of the bad old days and just gradually degrade over time.
Yeah, there's a good column about this by Anand Giridharadas in the New York Times today, talking about negative versus positive free speech, which is not a division of categories I'd heard before, but I think this related to what you were just saying, right? I mean, there's the vision of free speech that Elon Musk is articulating when he says, even my worst critics should have a place on Twitter, and the form of free speech that protects the speech of people who would otherwise be bullied and harassed. So I just think that there's a very thin line between, hey, my critics can say everything they want, I'm all for free speech, and, you know, Nazis can say everything they want, and rapists can say everything they want. And, you know, that kind of vision of free speech that, as you say, applied before on the platform, and that at least some measures had been taken to try to correct for.
Yeah, and Twitter had moved toward that vision of sort of more positive free speech over time. And it had been working on a lot of projects in that vein. It had also been working on a lot of interesting research projects about bias in algorithms and how it can correct for like racial bias in image cropping algorithms. They had teams doing really interesting work. In fact, it had become a place where folks disenchanted with other social media companies had gone to work. So I have sources at Twitter who used to work at Facebook and who moved to Twitter so that they could feel good about the work they were doing. I think a lot of people felt like the company was moving in the right direction on some of those fronts, and they're concerned that Musk will take them back to where they used to be. There was a good Charlie Warzel newsletter in The Atlantic today. He wrote this story for BuzzFeed years ago where Twitter was called a honeypot for assholes, and that's what they've been moving away from. And he said, you know, that's what people are worried Musk will move it back to.
I mean, it's kind of hard to see what his motivation for buying Twitter would be anyway, if it wasn't that, right? I mean, it's one of two things. Either he is acquiring it as a toy and he's not really going to mess with it that much at all and is just going to go on to his next showboating big buy of a company or whatever it is. Or he is specifically buying it because he wants to put Trump back on, you know, unleash the version of free speech that he prefers and make it a worse place. And I guess that's what, you know, everyday users of Twitter like me are scared will happen, that the tone of the platform will change. And while I personally haven't experienced harassment as a big problem, I would definitely want to get off the platform if I felt like that was rising, you know, in other communities. I wouldn't want to be part of a platform that started to feel more and more musky by the day, even if it didn't directly affect my Twitter.
I want to ask you, Dana and Will, about your own evolving relationships with Twitter as the two Twitter power users on this. But before we do that, I just want, Will, your assessment of Musk. Like, there seems to be no figure in American capitalism right now that is more like a Bond villain. Like, he was like, I'm going to master technology and outbid all of the car companies in the world and figure out how to make the first electric car and make it cool and make it good. And then, like, he did, and it worked. Like, you know, he did advance the cause of electric cars. You can debate, you know, about the environmental impact of the electrification of cars, I gather, but, you know, he like did that. You know, then being like, rockets next, like, there's like a physicality, a manufacturing physicality to the stuff that he has seemed interested in that is both intriguing and also is part of what makes him seem like a character rather than a human. Twitter is such like a small pixely place. It's so virtual. Like, it just seems so out of character. And he seems increasingly unhinged as the days go on, which may be true of all of us, but seems particularly true of him. Like, what's your read on him? I know he's famously unreadable, Will, but you've been studying this space for years.
Yeah, there aren't a lot of real world situations where the logic of the Marvel Cinematic Universe applies, but Elon Musk might be the exception. You know, I mean, famously the Tony Stark character was partly modeled on him. He really sees himself as a superhero, I think. I think he grew up feeling that he was smarter than everybody around him, that the world was run by sheep, that he alone can kind of step outside the matrix and see things as they are. And so he started these companies to, you know, with goals nothing less ambitious than saving the world. Tesla would get us off of carbon-based fuels. SpaceX would give us the escape hatch to Mars. Neuralink would fuse machine and human as never before. Now, recently, he's like gotten into companies that have sort of more mundane goals, like the Boring Company, which digs tunnels, is supposed to solve traffic. Like, okay, I guess. It kind of feels like he's so deep in his own head now that anything that just annoys him in his daily life becomes an obsession that he wants to solve. So, like, he doesn't like traffic. All right, he's going to solve traffic with tunnels in the Hyperloop. He now spends a ton of his time on Twitter. He's an addict like me, probably more than, maybe even more than me. He posts memes. He has all these followers who adore him and respond to everything he says. This is his metaverse. I mean, this is his digital world where he feels like he is this king or godlike figure. And so, of course, it matters deeply to him how that world is run. It matters deeply to him that he doesn't get kicked off someday for saying the wrong thing. I genuinely think that part of his rationale here, whether he realizes it or not, is just his own personal fear of losing access to Twitter or having it be run in a way that ruins the experience for him. So I just think he's blinkered by his own experience. He wants to make sure that Twitter works in a way that works for him because it's a huge part of his life now.
That's pretty scary. I mean, just in a almost existential sense that anyone has enough money to, you know, to have that kind of power and to be able to extend their personal brain universe in a way that affects the entire world. Before we wrap, though, I wanted to hear a little bit about, since, you know, you just called yourself a Twitter addict, as Julia pointed out, you and I are probably the people that would be the most affected by this if the company does change or the tone of the site changes, because we're there all the time. So what do you think? If what would it take for you to quit Twitter? And what is your relationship to the site right now before Elon Musk has taken it over?
So I live in Delaware and I work remotely. And so for me, Twitter is my portal to the world of media and the world of politics and public life. It's, you know, I can go on there and discuss ideas or trade jokes with people who are in the same professional world as me. And whereas my neighbors here in Delaware have, you know, may not share those interests. So it's really important to my life in like a genuine way, as much as we all talk shit about Twitter and how, what a horrible hell site it is. I don't see myself, I'm ashamed to say, I don't see myself leaving Twitter anytime soon. I think actually the people though who will be most affected are people of color, are women, are trans people, are Jewish people, anybody who is the target of hate on Twitter, I think has to really worry about what Musk's ownership augurs for the future of that platform. And I would not blame anybody who's making preparations to find some other portal to the wider world than Twitter, given this change in ownership.
Yeah, I think I'm somewhere near you in terms of my usage, although I don't, you know, live somewhere that I consider remote from other places. The pandemic made us all remote from all other places. And somehow in the past 2 years, as I've said before on this show, Twitter kind of became my workplace. You know, it feels like the closest thing we have to a shared workspace as journalists. Which is also why I put limits on my usage, and I try not to go on weekends. I try to make it actually feel like a workspace that I don't always have to be in, because it can bring you down. But yeah, it would really be a shame if it becomes a place only where, you know, where bullying is the main activity, because I think it is actually a good place for fostering work relationships and even real life friendships, and certainly for exchanging real time information. So, and I mean, honestly, Jack, I hate to say it, but Jack Dorsey is right when he says that it shouldn't be a privately owned company. It feels to me just like Facebook or any of those places that this should be a public utility that's regulated. You know, then that's a whole other conversation that's obviously not going to happen. But at the very least, as you were saying, it should not be owned by, you know, the closest thing we have to a Bond villain who's petting a baby albino kangaroo as he makes his decisions.
Yeah, I meant to complete the thought earlier that, you know, the Marvel universe doesn't have a lot to tell us about the moral logic of real life. But I think one thing it gets right that applies to Elon Musk is that there's a thin line between being a superhero and a supervillain. And Musk is always walking right on that line.
Will, you gave us the perfect tagline there. It's great to have you back, and let's do it again soon. We'll keep a close eye on this space, as they say.
Thanks. It was great to talk to you.
All right. Now is the moment in the podcast when we endorse. Dana, what do you have?
Steve, I have twin endorsements, or rather cousin endorsements, both involving descendants of the Menkiewicz brothers. So this past weekend, I went to the LA Times Book Festival to be on a panel, actually, with our beloved Isaac Butler, who was just on this show. He was talking about his new book, The Method. I, of course, was talking about Cameraman. And our other panelist was named Nick Davis, who has a new book called Competing with Idiots about the Menkiewicz brothers, Herman and Joe Menkiewicz, the screenwriters, directors, you know, Hollywood forces of the mid-20th century. He is actually a member of the Menkiewicz family. Herman is his grandfather, Joe is his great uncle, and his book, in addition to exploring them and their careers, talks a little bit about his family life and his relationship, his mother's relationship to that family. It's a wonderful book, so I'm endorsing Competing with Idiots by Nick Davis. And then, as it happens, while I was in LA at the LA Times Festival of Books, I was missing another festival, the TCM Classic Film Festival, something I've always wanted to go to, and maybe I will attend one day. And I happened upon a clip where Ben Menkiewicz, a cousin of Nick Davis, the author, and who is a descendant of Joe Menkiewicz, Herman's brother, and who is also, of course, famously a host on TCM, interviewing Bruce Dern. And he interviews him about his whole career. Bruce Dern is an unbelievably funny storyteller, just such a sharp mind, and a really, really fun interview. And that clip is up online now. So we'll put a link to that on the show page. And we'll also put a link to Competing with Idiots, Nick Davis's book.
That is amazing. I mean, I would love to hear the Bruce Dern. I mean, talk about a guy who got so bound up in his own star persona playing psychos in 70s paranoid thrillers. And it seemed to seep into him, maybe superficially, so that he's out there as a crack storyteller. You know, that's really cool. I really want to hear that. Julia, what do you have?
I have an endorsement that's actually like an RFP, request for proposals for unpaid labor by our listeners. So I took a spring break in Hawaii last month, and we all got COVID and had to stay in our hotel rooms and it stank. But I did at the very end get to go snorkeling for a day. And I'm not a huge snorkeler. I haven't done it a ton in my life. Like, I never went to anywhere tropical growing up. So it's not something I've been doing very long. And if you've ever done it, you know, it's like so weird and beautiful, and you feel, it feels crazy to be seeing this underwater world. And all the fishes are so extraordinary. They look like little beautiful sugar candies, like with their spun sugar stripes and swirls. And why are they those colors? And, you know, I probably saw 40 different gorgeous fishes. And then, because I'm a birder, I was like, what do I do with this observation? And I like came out and I started Googling like fish guides, and like I wanted to apply the lens of birding to snorkeling and like go on eFish and like identify the fish I'd seen and mark the fish down. But I don't get the sense that that is what snorkel scuba culture is. Like, I don't feel like the underwater watchers are like species collectors in the way that we avian fans are. So my recommendation is snorkeling. Like, if you have an opportunity to snorkel, snorkel. Or maybe my recommendation is beautiful fish. Like, I don't have more specific information than that. But really what I want is for the no doubt abundant snorkel scuba experts among our listeners, of whom I am sure there are at least a handful, to explain to me, like, what do you do when you're like a serious snorkeler? Like, do you learn the identities of the fish, or do you not bother? And if you learn them, do you record them, or do you not bother? I want, like, please explain snorkel culture to me through the lens of bird culture. If you are both a snorkeler and a birder, even better. So that's my unpaid RFP. Please write us at culturefest@slate.com and sate my curiosity about what happens when you get deep into fish fandom.
Okay, well, I have the somewhat sorry fate of endorsing something that I really want to pound the table on and suspect a vanishingly small percentage of listeners are going to follow up on. But I seriously encourage you to do it. Last night, I was kind of whiling away the very pleasant evening at home. I'd left NPR on after Terry Gross had gone off the air, and a local show came on. I'd never heard of it before. It comes from some, you know, independent production shop that sells to my local NPR station. It's called Alternative Radio. For all I know, they've got a huge following. And the person says, it sounds like a live event. And the host says, okay, tonight we have Timothy Snyder to talk about the origins of the Holocaust. And on comes Snyder. Of course, the, you know, he's now very well known for On Tyranny, the book On Tyranny, his various extremely learned takes on the Russian and Ukraine situation, and the Yale professor who contributes regularly to the New York Review of Books. Anyway, I was like, sure, I'll listen to Timothy Snyder. I'm going to admire him to no end. I've endorsed stuff of his before. And Snyder did the most interesting thing. He had, it comes from 2015, so obviously pre-invasion of Ukraine. And he understood that he had 1 hour in this format, and he's talking about a book that he's just published, though he never explicitly says that, but it's the thesis of a recently published book of his at the time, Black Earth. And so he talks for 1 hour without taking one breath or pausing. I've never heard anything like it. It sounded extemporaneous. He wasn't reading, but it was so lucid that you never wanted him to slow down and re-say anything. It wasn't disconcerting. You felt, as soon as you caught the tune of it, you were like, I want to hear all of this, and I want him to follow it from beginning to end. And what he does is he says two things about the Holocaust that I think the book is known for having a set of quite original insights into the causes and the prosecution of the Holocaust. He says First of all, he begins by saying it's the product of a super highly developed worldview on the part of Hitler. So he went back and reread not only Mein Kampf, but basically probably everything Hitler ever wrote. And he shows in a completely new way to me how extermination came to seem inevitable in Hitler's mind, and also the Lebensraum and like the whole, you know, essentially the invasion of Poland and the Soviet Union were part of this worldview. But secondly, how the Holocaust actually unfolds, the way it unfolds is as a series of accidents and contingencies, that the actual prosecution and carrying out of it happens through a set of unanticipated experiential discoveries by the Nazis as they begin to move east into Poland and the Soviet Union. And clearly they had, you know, a final solution to the Jewish problem in mind all along. There's nothing exonerating about this theory at all, but it's about why the killing preponderantly took place in Poland and Eastern Europe. And it's, I can't tell you just the utter brilliance of the performance, but of course the deeply morally serious implications of it as they apply to 2022. And it's about how a certain worldview develops and how what its most nightmare implications are, and the parallel to Putin's mentality and how Putin has evolved a mentality of, I mean, most obviously persecution, and but also why he would want to expand into Ukraine inexorably. You know, of course, you're only making that analogy in your own head. This is from 7 years ago. But I think we're going to link to the audio so it's available for anyone to listen to at any point. I would say, you know, I would really, really seriously encourage people to listen to it. I think it was an important thing to learn. Julia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dana, that was a good one.
Stephen, it was a pleasure.
You can find links to the things we talked about today at slate.com/culturefest. And of course, you can email us at culturefest@slate.com. We love getting your emails and we try to respond. The intro music to our show is by Nicholas Britell. Our production assistant is Nadira Goff. Our producer is Cameron Drews. For Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you soon.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queen say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.